Good morning. May it please the court, Santino Chakoti, on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Tiffany Parker. The issues before the court today involve the evidence required to admit printouts from a social media website, in this case Facebook, and what is required to authenticate that evidence before properly admitted. And secondly, the position of the appellant is that the trial court in this case erroneously admitted what the state claimed were entries from the defendant's Facebook profile that were, I guess for better in a better sense, copied and pasted onto the complainant's profile page. So they weren't directly printed from the defendant's website, Facebook profile. 901A governs authentication for evidence in this jurisdiction, and we know that for authentication or identification, it's a condition precedent to admissibility, and it requires the sponsoring party, in this case, state, to present sufficient evidence to support a finding that the matter in question is what is purported to be. The state did not appropriately authenticate the screenshots from Parker's Facebook profile that were eventually published on the complainant's profile because there was a missing link between who authored the entries and where exactly they came from.
Can you discuss a little bit about the role of the trial judge in initially determining whether there's sufficient evidence of authenticity to submit it to the jury under 104. What should the trial judge, what can he do or she do, and what should the trial judge do?
Well, I think with respect to this kind of evidence, Justice Ridgely, there needs to be some background information about how this evidence operates or functions. So in this case, to answer your question, specifically, what he should have done, our position is to provide, or the state should have provided some type of background about how social media operates. It's not like a letter where the rational trier of fact is going to understand whether a letter is forged or who signed it or, you know, with respect to those methods of authentication. In dealing with this type of evidence, some type of background about social media websites in general, what type of passwords or usernames might be required to access the website. In this case, the record reflects that a social worker had gone to the complainant, had gone with the complainant to the Attorney General's office to print this screenshot. So you know if you're working on your computer, you have a website up, you just print that shot of the screen. That's all we know, how this Exhibit 5, in the state's case, was put into evidence. The social worker didn't testify. So going back to your question, it would have been probably best practice to have somebody who had firsthand knowledge of how this document was printed, how they obtained the information, and, you know, at least we're further along than where we are today. But none of that was done. There was no background information in this case.
Can, under 104, can the trial judge consider hearsay and inadmissible evidence in deciding the threshold issue of admissibility?
Our position would be no, that there needs to be an adequate foundation before this evidence is purported what the state claims it to be. And that's precisely why our sister jurisdiction in Maryland, in the Griffin decision, had a strikingly similar set of facts. And they laid out a three-part test of different ways to get this type of evidence in. Now, interestingly enough, if we look at the record carefully, the trial judge goes down that road when he takes a break before deciding whether he's going to admit this evidence into the record or allow the state for authentication purposes, and he cites the Griffin decision. I believe it's on page 11 of the defendant's appendix. And he goes through the various steps, one being you can ask the purported author or creator of this website or entries whether they in fact altered it or virtually penned it. And that wasn't done here. So had Ms. Parker, who took the stand at trial, been asked by the state whether this is her Facebook profile or these are entries, I probably wouldn't be here this morning.
Well, let's look at that. The state's trying to get the evidence in its case in chief. So you'd think it has to have the foundation to get it in its case in chief. And are you suggesting that somehow they could have not introduced it during its case in chief, waited until the defendant decided to testify, and then somehow introduced it during the course of cross-examination, or cross-examined the defendant and then introduced it, you know, in rebuttal? What's the dynamics of getting it in?
As long as it's properly authenticated, we don't take issue with when the state can admit the Facebook pages.
Well, in my scenario, according to your argument, the state would not get it in during its case in chief. Is that correct?
Because Ms. Parker didn't testify in their case in chief, that's correct. Under that, only under the first part of the Griffin test. So another option would have been to have somebody with access to Ms. Parker's computer, since we all unwittingly leave a computer trail when we use computers, to say, somebody logged in with this computer, with this screen name. That's probably enough, as the Court of Appeals of Maryland decided. That's also going to be enough to authenticate this piece of evidence.
Is it your position that the three ways in Griffin should be the only way to admit social media evidence?
I think the rationale in Griffin is the framework that they provided seems to be the most complete as to how this evidence comes in. It's also the same methods that the Judicial Court of Massachusetts has a similar procedure. I believe it's the Williams decision that we cite in our papers in to this court.
And go ahead.
In those cases, the critical factor is matching up or linking the author to the profile. And the reason why this is of a concern is because we're dealing with a form of evidence that, as Magistrate Judge Grimm in the Lorraine decision indicated, is evolving, it's ever-changing, and it's prone to fraud and manipulation. So I think the latest statistics are that some 8% of Facebook profiles are fraudulent, or they're people masquerading as other individuals. Because we're dealing with this type of evidence, this is why we have to be so careful about authentication.
Is there a substantial difference between this in some way and the way in which we approach the voluntariness of a confession? By that I mean typically the defense raises some issue of substance that suggests that the evidence should not be admitted. It's a question both for the trial judge and ultimately submitted to the jury. What was the substantial, if any, problem that was raised by the defense about the introduction of the evidence apart from authentication? By that I mean something that says, here is a reason why it is not authentic.
Chief, I think the main reason is because of it appeared that the parties understood that when dealing with these Facebook postings, they did not know who could have authored or virtually penned these entries. along that note, it's the way we get these entrants is also interesting. We get them by means of they're posted on a public domain, and according to the complainant in this case, she copied and pasted what she found on someone else's Facebook site onto her Facebook site. So, but the means by which these were obtained raised questions to the parties, including the judge, to the point where he looked at the Griffin decision and said, wait a second, we have some guidance by the Court of Appeals in Maryland. Now, I think where he went astray, if you look at the record carefully, he acknowledges the three avenues in Griffin which the state can use to get this in. And when he looks at the first, method, which is first-hand knowledge that the author or creator of this profile actually penned these entries, he says, well, I think we have that. And I think what he's considering is that the complainant received the entries, but she did not have first-hand knowledge that Parker wrote them. So I think what he's thinking is somebody's with Parker as she's typing this, and that's why they can come in, because we have first-hand knowledge that Parker wrote this. The issue in these cases, Griffin, Williams, is that the profile might belong to the defendant in those cases, but we don't know whether they actually authored the entries. That's the problem.
Now, the trial judge relied on 901B4, which allows exhibits to be authenticated or identified by appearance, content, substance, internal patterns, or other distinctive characteristics taken in conjunction with circumstances. So it's basically a circumstantial evidence approach. Is that so?
That's correct, Justice Ridgeley.
If we accept your position that the three ways listed in Griffin are the only path to admissibility, then this decision would essentially say 901B4 cannot be used for social media evidence. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's correct, and for this reason. There are cases that have admitted, and I believe the Pennsylvania Superior Court decision that the state cites in its brief, and I believe that's in the interest of FP, it's a 2005 Superior Court decision. There is an exception that if there are distinctive characteristics, and let me give you an example of such. If two people are instant messaging or sending text messages back and forth, and they have screen names, you know, everyone, it seems like with all these accounts, pseudonyms are used routinely, and someone during the conversation actually reveals who they are or where they're from or gives information that only those users might know, that would seem to bypass the need to have someone admit that they sent it, or have somebody from the instant messaging application or software come in and say this is who logged in, or even search the computer records. So I think the distinctive characteristics could still apply for various situations. The problem in this case is that we don't have a one-on-one communications. It's a public posting. It's like somebody putting something for the whole world to see, which is, you know, for the better part, how Facebook's used, as opposed to two people engaging in conversation with each other.
Well, I'd like to talk about the circumstantial evidence that may, or that at least convince the trial judge, that this was made, this was posted by your client. Doesn't the Facebook posting refer to the victim hitting Parker first?
My understanding of the record is that the entries were incriminating, prejudicial, hence we were asking that a new trial be ordered, but it's general information about the altercation between both Parker and Brown in this case. So I think this would be authentication would be perhaps easier to find if there were names used in the posting, if it was clear that she was talking, that this individual, whoever virtually penned it, was talking to Ms. Brown and saying, I did this to you, this is Tiffany, or you know who this is. It was my understanding from the record is that it was general information about the altercation. And we're talking about an altercation.
Let me read you the last paragraph. I told you go ahead, and you inboxed me back, still being disrespectful. I told you say no more. I seen you today. We said our words. You put your hands on me. I hit you back. Isn't that used by your client's trial counsel as showing that she acted in self-defense?
That was only after the trial court rejected the initial argument by defense counsel to not have these admitted at all. So this was the alternative. This was plan B for defense counsel. If he was not going to have all of these entries not admitted into evidence, excluded entirely, then he was going to use whatever he could from those messages to use against him.
Bottom line, my question is it an inference that can be drawn that this posting was in some way favorable to your client, and therefore that was an indication that it may have come from your client as opposed to the victim, allegedly?
I think had the entries been excluded entirely, that's the position that the client should have been in, the defendant should have been in. There was still incriminating evidence in there that this was a credibility contest. This was she said type of case. And when this information came in, it made it sound like for sure that there was an altercation and that Ms. Parker may have even been, the aggressor in some ways. So I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
We'll let you save the rest of your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
And in rebuttal, I would appreciate it if you'd address the harmless error issue.
Certainly.
May it please the Court, good morning. Andrew Vella on behalf of the State. Your Honors, it is the State's position that the Superior Court did not abuse its discretion by admitting the defendant's Facebook posting regarding the attack on the victim. The evidence was properly authenticated under DRE 901, and in other words, the trial judge applied 901 correctly. Rule 901 imposes a minimal burden on the State. It's a burden that has been described by this court as lenient and easily met. The trial judge's role in authentication under 901 is to act as the gatekeeper. The trial judge is not the ultimate fact finder as to the authenticity of the evidence. That is the function of the jury. The trial judge needs to find that there is a rational basis in the evidence presented from which the jury can find that the evidence is connected with the defendant in this particular case. That's what this court has said in Cabrera.
Well, isn't this a particularly troublesome area where electronic postings can be fabricated? Why shouldn't the state, or anyone for that matter, have to do a little more than just print out a page and introduce it, seek to introduce it?
The state's position is that just because the medium is different does not make it any more susceptible to fraud. People can pen a fraudulent letter as easily as they can type one out on email. The question of whether it is what the state says it is or the proponent of the evidence says it is really for the jury to decide ultimately. And the rule is flexible and is written to be flexible enough to deal with emerging forms of media. That's why the state would suggest you have 901 before that deals with circumstantial evidence and distinctive characteristics. It's not the media that determine the distinctive characteristics. It's the evidence itself that the state is talking about. So that when we say, well, it's susceptible to fraud because it is electronic, the state, there's no support in the record for that, certainly in this case. And it's no more susceptible than any other traditional form of media. And the rule is equipped to deal with that. And the trial judge has to act as the gatekeeper for that, certainly. But
well, how does the trial judge do that under 104 when a printout is presented? What is the trial judge supposed to do?
The trial judge is supposed to look at the evidence and see if under 901, under 901B4, are there distinctive characteristics? Is there someone with personal knowledge here who can testify about this evidence that the proponent is putting before the court and trying to get in front of a jury? In this case, you had Shania Brown testify that she had previously communicated via Facebook with Tiffany Parker. Tiffany Parker acknowledged that. But even if we don't get to the defense's case, prior to the admission of this evidence, you had that circumstantial evidence. Prior contact via Facebook, Tiffany Parker. The posting itself, distinct in characteristics in terms of it identifies the account from which it came from. The name is Tiffany Parker. The picture is of Tiffany Parker. It relates to the offense that had just happened.
What was the time interval between the offense and the posting?
It's the state's recollection that is within a day that was posted. This is similar to one of the cases that the state cited, Tienda. In Tienda, the defendant himself made a posting talking about making reference to the victim, the crime, who was present, the police investigation. And the Tienda court found that all of those circumstances, and there was also additional evidence used to authenticate it, but the court found that the state had met its burden in authenticating that evidence and those postings from Tienda, essentially acknowledging that he participated in the crime. And the state would suggest the circumstantial evidence here under 901B4 was present for the trial court to find that the state had properly authenticated the evidence. The defense cites to Griffin and Williams as being somewhat controlling or at least as persuasive authority from sister jurisdictions. However, I believe this gets back to the questions that the court had initially. What is the role of the trial judge? Those cases substantially change the role of the trial judge. Those cases call for, and in their words, an enhanced scrutiny on that evidence. And that takes the fact-finding function away from the jury and puts it in the hands of the judge. And the rule here in Delaware is that the judge is the ultimate fact-finder on those. On those issues, the judge is not the fact finder. The judge is the gatekeeper. The judge need not be satisfied, him or herself, that the evidence is in fact authentic. The judge need only be satisfied that a reasonable jury could conclude that the evidence is in fact authentic. And that's what this court said in Cabrera. So when we take a look at Griffin and we take a look at Williams, that would no longer be true. And what the defense would have is essentially a footnote or an addendum, as Justice Ridgely said, saying, 901B4 does not apply to social media evidence, or generally, I would suggest, electronic evidence, and merely because of its form.
Once the trial judge makes a finding that it's authenticated, as here, and it goes to the jury, what is the jury told about its role in regard to that specific evidence?
The jury is just given, I believe the jury is given the standard instruction. I don't believe the jury is specially instructed as to the authenticity of the evidence. And the jury is free. The defense in these cases, and I think this kind of gets to the state's point, the defense under the current construction of the rule, the defense is still free to argue. And that's what the cases that the state cited, the defense is still free to argue the authenticity and say, for whatever reason, you should not believe that this is what the state or the proponent says it is. The rule, that's built in. And the defense is always free to argue that. And I don't know that we specially instruct the jury, other than as to credibility of witnesses, the type of evidence, circumstantial evidence, the standard instructions. I don't know that we specifically instruct them about evidence where there's been a question about authentication. But the defense is still free to argue those things. And that's what the Griffin Court said. The dissent says you're still free to argue that.
But isn't that the purpose of a special instruction? Normally, if the judge admits evidence, the jury would assume the judge has decided it's properly admitted. This is a type of situation, as the Chief Justice mentioned, by analogy to the voluntariness of a confession, where the jury is entitled to revisit the issue. So why wouldn't we instruct the jury that they could revisit the authenticity of this evidence?
I don't know that it's necessary to instruct the jury as such, and I believe there's somewhat of a distinction between 901 evidence and perhaps the voluntariness of a confession. This is more of a technical evidentiary issue as opposed to a constitutional issue that a court has already ruled on when we say a defendant's statement is coming in because the court has determined it's voluntary. The court's made a different decision, and the state would suggest on a different level. The state suggests a very evidentiary, almost a purely evidentiary issue, as opposed to one of more constitutional dimension.
Well, do you agree, as defense counsel suggested, that this was a credibility he said, she said, or in this case she said, she said? In other words, a closed case because it turned on the credibility of the complainant versus the defendant?
The state would suggest there was a credibility issue, and certainly the jury had to decide whether or not that self-defense claim made by Parker was credible. However, there was a lot of other evidence that suggested certainly that that this was a one-sided fight, and it was not Brown who was the aggressor. We had the independent witness, Felicia Johnson, who said she didn't know how it started, but it certainly looked like Tiffany Parker was getting the better of Shania Brown. The officers came, and it was, in fact, Shania Brown who was injured and 8.5 months pregnant. Tiffany Parker was not injured. So to the extent that it was a close case, certainly the jury had to consider the self-defense claim that was made. But the state would suggest that even if we take this Facebook posting out, and the posting itself is a dual-edged sword to the extent that it implicates Tiffany Parker in the assault, but it's also self-serving because it does say, you hit me first, we had our words, you hit me first, and I hit you back. So it established that she was there involved in the fight with Shania Brown, but it also was used to buttress her self-defense claim in closing. But even if we were to take that out, the state suggests it's still harmless error, because there was enough of a record for the jury to convict her. And Tiffany Parker had testified.
I had someone demonstrate for me once that you can spoof someone's email in a matter of a minute, because I saw him do it. Isn't this an area where there should be particular concern about the ability to manipulate electronically emails and other information, so that just having an identifier alone, like a picture, is not enough?
The state's position is that that is a concern with every form of evidence, and the fact that electronic communication is much more prevalent now than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago, when perhaps the more prevalent form of communication was typewritten or handwritten notes. The state suggests that concern doesn't change, because we still have that concern with other forms of evidence. So the concern doesn't change. The prevalence of the medium certainly has changed, and it is easy to spoof an email. It may be easy to post on someone else's website or someone else's, under someone else's name on a Facebook account, or draw up a fake Facebook account. But it's just as easy to pen a letter in someone else's name, to copy a piece of letterhead that is not your own and send it off claiming whatever you might claim under someone else's name. The medium should not control the rule.
Well, let's assume that it doesn't. Let's assume the medium is not the message. Let's assume that there is a typed letter sent from someone's hometown that has an incriminating statement in it. It has a signature, purported signature of that person. Why are the steps any different for that than they are for this? And don't those steps include a methodology for authentication? It's not as simple that it came from the hometown of the person. It sounds like something they might have said. It's an admission against interest. Therefore, the jury will determine whether that letter is authentic.
The methodology shouldn't be different. The standard should also not be different. For the state's position is that it really boils down to what is this court going to treat as the standard under 901? What Griffin and Williams say is this is enhanced scrutiny because it is electronic. And what this court has said in the past is that there just has to be a rational basis connecting the defendant with the evidence that the proponent is putting in. So, I understand the court's point, but we should not have a different mechanism. The rule is flexible and written flexibly enough so that we can deal with these things. Fraud is something that is a concern, certainly when we deal with almost any form of evidence where it's contested. But aside from the fact that wasn't the case here, there was no contesting whether Tiffany Parker wrote this. That's not in the record. It's not whether someone came in and spoofed her account. In this case, that was not an issue. The issue raised simply was by the defense, I don't know if they can authenticate it, I don't know if they have the witnesses, and the state's position was Tiffany Parker is a person with knowledge, and this posting in and of itself has enough distinctive characteristics for the court to find that the state has authenticated it, to allow it into evidence.
Well, how much contrary evidence need there be, or does it never matter? On the other side, before it becomes inadmissible, let's assume you have this printout of this page, and then the other side, let's assume it's addressed through some kind of pretrial ruling, and there's a hearing, and the defendant testifies for the limited purpose of saying, my account was hacked, that's not mine. Let's assume they go farther, and they bring in forensic experts who search her computer, and the computer shows that there's no indication of a posting from her computer. Is that, would this still be admissible under the rule from your perspective, based on what the state presented on one side, no matter what was there in opposition to it?
The state's position, the court in Connecticut faced the same issue in Ellick. In that case, those Facebook postings were not admitted. And the fact scenario was that in Ellick, the victim, there was a posting made in the name of the victim on Facebook, on the victim's Facebook account. And the defense wanted to use that posting to contradict some testimony on cross-examination. and essentially it was the victim said she hadn't contacted the defendant since his arrest, but on Facebook there was this kind of exchange saying, that's a really nice car, saw you got a new car, just to contradict that for that very small purpose. However, that victim testified, had a hearing outside the presence of the jury in the middle of a trial, and the victim testified saying, I stopped using that Facebook account three months ago. I believe it was hacked. I did not make those postings. And the court found that there was not enough evidence to authenticate, or there was nothing in the record to, or not enough in the record to authenticate that Facebook posting where the victim said, I didn't make it, my account was hacked. So certainly the quantum of evidence might not be that great to oppose it. In this case, there was nothing presented. But going forward, the court sees, or the state sees, certainly your point, Justice Ridgely, in that what if it's contested? What if there's evidence to the contrary? And the state would suggest a trial judge would have to weigh that evidence that contradicts the proponent's evidence and determine whether or not the proponent of the evidence has met the burden, and just to apply the rule. And it shouldn't be an enhanced burden. That's the state's position. The judge just has to apply the rule and the standard, considering the evidence and seeing whether or not, in fact, the proponent of the evidence has met the burden under the rule. And if they have, certainly allow the opponent of the evidence to argue and present evidence in their case.
So under your methodology, under the rule as you're proposing, if you take the facts of a contested situation, the judge would still have discretion to keep the evidence out if the judge was convinced that a reasonable juror would not accept it.
Absolutely. Under that scenario, the judge has to apply the rule and the standard. And the judge can, if the judge is satisfied that no reasonable juror could find that the evidence is connected with the defendant, keep it out. It's just an application of the rule. The state is advocating no change in the rule because the rule is equipped to deal with these situations. And if we change the rule, if this court changes the rule to be consistent with Griffin and Williams, that will substantially change the role of the trial judge and take it into more of a fact-finding role, which is not contemplated by the rule or the cases. If there are no further questions from the court, thank you.
I believe the chief wanted to address first the plain versus harmless error, issue.
Both in the brief and in the oral argument, the state suggested even if it was error to admit the evidence of the Facebook posting.
Our position is rather straightforward, and I think, Chief, you summed up our position. That was, this was a credibility contest at trial. There were, I believe, one witness who testified who drove by the scene and saw the altercation. The altercation happened also next to a barber shop, so I don't believe anybody else from the scene testified. This was a she said. It was a close case. I think the state in many ways admitted that it was a close case, that based on the credibility of the people involved in the altercation. And for that reason, this evidence, it would be conjecture to assume that this evidence didn't play a role with the jury. And let me also add that it's not just that the evidence is before the jury. This court makes an important point that if the jury is not instructed on how to use this evidence or how they're supposed to apply it, that's also problematic because, just recently, I realize this court formed the Commission for Law and Technology. This court recognizes that technology terms as often, we cannot assume that these juries understand how Facebook works. It's just, it's not, we're not there yet. If you show them a letter, sure, that's fine. But to just give them a printout, admit it into evidence and say this is a Facebook entry, admit it as Parker's words, she altered this, that's a leap. That's a leap that I don't believe should have been permitted.
I'd like to ask you, if my colleagues agree, with the red light on,
sure.
A different hypothetical. Let's assume your side has three experts who, at a pretrial hearing, say this does not come from the defendant's computer, and the defendant testifies, I did not author that. I got hacked. And the prosecution comes back with three other experts who say their analysis is flawed and so-and-so heard an admission from the defendant that she sent this posting or made this posting. Does the trial judge in that case pick a side, or does the trial judge give it to the jury to decide?
His role, his or her role as the gatekeeper, I would say, can factor both the probative evidence and decide whether it comes in. The problem here is there's just nothing to authenticate this person. If we had something in your example, Justice Ridgely, then maybe it's a closer case if we've got someone coming in. I know the state uses the Texas case in Tenada. I'd like to just add what they failed to explain is that in that case, MySpace records were subpoenaed, and they used those records to admit that evidence. So they had something. In this case, there's just nothing.
Thank you, counsel. I'll take the case under advisement and recess.